Go ahead and open your Bibles to John chapter 4. The Gospel of John chapter 4. And if you did your homework for this week, by the time you get to chapter 3, the book gets much more interesting if you noticed. Did anybody notice that? The book was much more interesting and relevant beginning at chapter 3. Now, the stuff in the first two chapters was good, but chapter 3 really starts to hit home for an individual as far as the missions realm. So I want to make a disclaimer up front that we won't get all the way through the assigned reading from last week this afternoon, because I want to take the time to look at culture shock and also something that he doesn't bring up, but what I call culture stress. And so we're going to take our time to work through those issues of culture shock today. And we won't get to finish up this section of the book until next week, because I want to take the time next week also to go through the cycle of culture shock and show you what it is and why it's important to understand it ahead of time. Okay, so we will not finish that this morning, or this afternoon. But what we're going to do now is I want to take you on a little excursion through John chapter 4, and we'll go ahead and begin at verse 1. But what I want to do is I want to have you think about something. Now, sometimes when you study culture and you want to be culturally aware and culturally relevant, sometimes we need to recognize that we do need to break cultural norms. That although we want to be culturally sensitive, at strategic times, we might need to go against the cultural grain. But we need to know why we're going to go against it, and we need to know how we're going to do it and what we're trying to produce by going against it. Most of the time, unless the cultural traits are unbiblical, we need to go along with them and try to impart spiritual truth and so forth. What we're going to do is we're going to look at Jesus today in John chapter 4, the ultimate missionary here on his mission, break a cultural norm. But he does it for a strategic reason and a purpose, and he doesn't generally do that. There are certain times when he does, but other times, most of the time, he doesn't. So we're going to look at one of those times where a cultural norm, although he was aware of it, he decided to break it. Okay? So, we're in John chapter 4, and let's pick it up at verse 1. It says, "Therefore, when the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself did not baptize but his disciples, he left Judea and departed again to Galilee. But he needed to go through Samaria." Now, I'm again assuming that most of you have somewhat of a knowledge of the Gospel of John and the New Testament, but if you look at it on a map, you have Judea down here in the south where Jerusalem is, and you have Galilee that's up in the north where Nazareth is, where Jesus is from, and there's a problem because there's some place in between there that they don't like, and that place is what? Samaria. And so usually, unless they were in a big hurry, if a Jew was going to go from Judea to Galilee or go from Galilee to Judea, they would bypass Samaria. They didn't want to go through Samaria because, and you'll see John makes a big issue out of this, and we'll talk about it in a minute, the Samaritans were there. And so we'll look at Samaritans in a minute. But I want you to notice verse 4 that John, the writer of this gospel, says that he was going to go to Galilee, but he needed to go through Samaria. Now, a Jew would never need to go through Samaria unless he was in a real hurry, and Jesus wasn't in a hurry. There was another reason why he needed to go through Samaria. So in verse 5, it says, "He came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph." So he gets into Samaria. And notice that Samaria has a history. It has a link with the patriarchs. It has a link all the way back to Jacob. He comes across this plot of ground, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground, that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. So there's a historical link there. But understand that land today is occupied by the Samaritans. It's Samaria. And so even though it had a historic link to the Jews would bypass it and avoid it because the Samaritans lived in that area. So, verse 6. "Now Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well, and it was about the sixth hour." So it was about noontime. We don't know what time of the year it is. A lot of people speculate that it was sometime around the hot time of the year. But anyway, it tells us in verse 6 that the well was there. Jesus was wearied from his journey, and he sat down by that well, and it was about noontime. Now, verse 7. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. And Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." Verse 8. For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. So get the picture. They're out in kind of a rural area in Samaria. They come to Jacob's well that has this link to their own people from years ago, but an area that's now avoided because of the connection with the Samaritans. Now, as they get there, Jesus is weary and he sits down by the well, and his disciples make a decision to go into the town and buy food. They're going to go in and buy lunch, basically. So Jesus says, "I'll hang out here." Well, as the disciples go, Jesus is sitting by the well, and you get this little nugget of information here. You get this little scene that is significant in the whole Gospel of John. And what it is a woman, verse 7, of Samaria came to draw water. And Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." Now, at this moment in time, when Jesus said to this Samaritan woman, "Give me a drink," he just broke a major cultural cultural tradition. Understand that as you, again, you study the time of the scripture, you want to look and understand the customs and the culture of the Jews at that time. When you study it, you find out that in public, Jewish men did not speak to women. Generally speaking, a man would not have a conversation in public with a woman who wasn't his wife. And there was obviously, you had a separation like you have in many days, in many countries today, where you have men over here and women over here. You call a meeting, and even in many churches around the world, you call a meeting, the women sit over here, the men sit over here. You have a potluck. After the potluck, the women go over here and the men go over here. It's a cultural thing. So Jesus is in Samaria. That would get your attention immediately, that he had to go through Samaria, even though he apparently wasn't in a hurry. And then this woman comes to him, and Jesus says to her, "Give me a drink." Now, John points out that the reason he asked her is because the disciples were in the town. If they would have been there, perhaps he would have asked them. But the reality of it was, they were gone. They were in the town. He let them go into town for a reason. Verse 9. The woman then of Samaria said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman?" This is a significant incident in the ministry of Christ. A Samaritan woman has come to draw water. And we'll talk a little bit more about why she's out here alone in the middle of the day drawing water. But the point of it is she's come to draw water from this well that she probably does every day. She goes in and draws water from this well. This day she walks up and there's a Jew sitting there. She immediately recognized him as a Jew, probably because of the clothes he was wearing. And he speaks to her. He initiates conversation with a woman in public and says, "Give me a drink." Now, this astounded her. Okay, this is now, we're coming to the point here. Verse 9. The woman of Samaria said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman?" It astounded her that he would speak to her at all, for two reasons. Number one, she's a woman. And Jewish men don't speak to other women besides their wives in public. But it was a double whammy because of why? She was also Samaritan. She was a Samaritan woman. It's not bad enough that she's a woman and he would speak to her in public. It's a double whammy that she is a Samaritan woman. So she's astounded at this cultural tradition that he's broken. And again, he's doing this strategically. So she said, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman?" And now here's the main point that I want you to see in the midst of this class, the next comment that John makes. For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Now you might read right by that and not even think about it. Hopefully not anymore now that you're in this class. But that's a significant statement. What this tells us is that the God who created culture, the God who communicated truth in culturally relevant ways in the Old Testament, the God who
by His Holy Spirit inspired Moses to talk about Egyptians not eating with Hebrews. The God who is aware of culture also gives us little nuggets that help us to understand some significant things in His Word. And culture plays a major part in that. Now listen, John says, Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. See, as John writes this, and he's writing it for a specific audience, as he writes it, he comes to this little episode, and you got to ask yourself the question, why did he include this? I mean, when you look at the Gospel of John, and if you've studied it, it's not chronological. The Gospel of John as a whole is not chronological. John, sitting back, wanting to write a book that would show clearly that Jesus is the Son of God, of all the miracles that Jesus did, John chooses 7 miracles and 7 I am statements that Jesus made to show that Jesus is the Son of God. So John writes with a different purpose in mind than the other writers, and he kind of plays loose with chronological order of things, you see? And so as you get in, and as again you study these different books, you find this. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they have everything in chronological, sequential order in the life of Christ, not John. So as John is writing his gospel, for some reason he thought that this little episode was important, that it needed to be included. And so the question is, why? What's significant about this? Well, again, the significance is that Jesus is not just the Son of David. Jesus is also the Son of Man. And you guys that were in the last class, you remember this when we got into the New Testament. Matthew, the gospel written for the Jews, keep in mind, in Matthew's genealogy, he traces Jesus back to Abram, that Jesus is the son of Abram. But keep in mind that it's Matthew's gospel that lists those two women in the genealogy of Christ. And they're not even Jewish women. They're Gentile women in the genealogy. And Matthew is the gospel in Matthew chapter 2 that says that the first people to worship Christ were Gentiles, the Magi, the ones that came from the East. When the real God, the missionary God, became man, and God made the declaration, He only declared it to two groups of people, Israelite shepherds and Magi from the East, Gentiles. The Gentiles come from the East, and they are the only ones that are recorded as worshiping Him as a child. The shepherds, it does not tell us, worshiped Him. So you see the bigger picture that Jesus, although He is the son of Abram, He's a Jew, He's also who? The Son of Man. He is the representative of all mankind. And so John, as he goes through his gospel, he wants to point out in different ways at different times that Jesus is the Son of Man, that His ministry and His mission was global. It wasn't just to redeem the Jewish people, to bring Jacob back. And Simeon in Luke chapter 2 makes this clear. When, remember Simeon, the old guy that was at the temple? And they bring Jesus in there when He's about 40 days old. And this Simeon takes the baby and holds up the baby and says, God, now I can die because I've seen Your salvation. And he says, now this is the one that You've brought into the world. And he speaks of the reality that He's not just to bring Jacob back, but also He's to be a light to the Gentiles. Okay? So, John has included this for a reason, inspired by the Holy Spirit. And what we find out then is Jesus has this little interaction, and most of you have probably heard a teaching on this about how to evangelize. It's a great little text for teaching the basics of evangelism. But understand, it's also a text having to do with culture and the place that culture plays and how strategically at certain times breaking a cultural tradition to further the kingdom of God is worth doing. Okay? Now, again, the point though, the simple point here is John could not continue the story and you would not feel the weight of what's happening here unless John tells us in verse 9, Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Now, when you read that and you ponder that, the weight of what Jesus just did should hit you. This was radical. This is why John's recording it for us. This was just not another day in the life of the ministry of Christ. This was radical that he would A, be in Samaria, and B, speak to a Samaritan woman, broke a cultural tradition. And a Jew reading that would immediately probably jump out of his chair. You mean our Messiah, the Christ, A, went into Samaria, and B, spoke personally to a Gentile woman, a Samaritan of all people? Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. And it's interesting that John has to record that for us. If he doesn't, do you feel the weight of it? Matter of fact, if I hadn't given you the background, or you're not Bible college, I mean, if you weren't Bible college students and you read this, it's like, what's the big deal? Jesus talks to a woman at the well, asks her for a drink of water. Duh. Who cares? What makes it significant is where he's at and the cultural norm that he breaks to do this. Everybody with me on that? Okay. Now, who were the Samaritans? Do you remember who the Samaritans were? What was their lineage? They were what we call mestizos in a lot of parts of the world. Remember when the Assyrians came and took Israel, a portion of Israel, the northern 10 tribes, took them into captivity. And then later, of course, Nebuchadnezzar came and took the other two tribes. What they did is they, in that area of Samaria, they left some of the Jews there, and then they imported other people in there and got them to intermarry. They brought other people in there, and so they were a mixture. They were part Jew and part some other group of people. And so they were what we call mestizos. They were half-breeds. And the Jewish people really despised them. I mean, it's bad enough to be a Gentile and have no Jewish blood running through you, but it's even worse when you have a mix. And so the Jews despised them. And the other thing that happened as a result of this mixture was they brought their religious truths, and now they've married the Jews, and so you had a hybrid religion. Okay? The Samaritans had a hybrid religion, and they, as this woman's going to ask about where God is to be worshipped at, they believe God should be worshipped at Mount Gerizim. So what you had the Samaritans doing was a mixture of what the Jews knew was the true way to worship God, but it was mixed with what the other ancestors had, and you had what we call syncretism. I think I've talked about that already. Have I talked about that? Syncretism? This is an important word for missions, so let me write this down. Syncretism. Okay? Basically, what syncretism is a mixture of that which is true with that which is false, so that you have a hybrid. It appears to be true, but when you really look at it and you look at many of the principles in it, it's contrary to the truth of God's word. It's called syncretism. And you have this in many different parts of the world today, because the original missionaries many times went out and didn't understand a lot of cultural habits and traits and so forth. And so they brought people to Christ, but they brought them to Christ along with a lot of their previous religious tradition, and they just let the thing become a mixture. And so that's what the Samaritans were. So John 4:9 is significant because it tells us that culture is important, that Jesus broke a cultural norm here, and the weight of what he was doing could not be felt unless you grab the truth. The Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Now, it's hard for us to relate to that as Americans, because, again, we live in a bubble. Our life here in America is totally unique to most of the rest of the world. And the racial equality that you have in America, even though it's not near what it ought to be, is nothing compared to the racial hatred in most of the rest of the world. You know, like I told you, I think, last week, Filipinos don't like the Chinese. They despise the Chinese, and the Chinese don't like them. And you go to many different countries, and you'll find incredible prejudice by ethnic groups, one against another. And they don't hide it. They don't try to be equal. They don't have affirmative action or hiring practices or any of the things that we have in our country. It's just flat out, you know, ethnic hatred towards one another. And the only contact you have with those other people is when you have to have it. If you had a choice, you would have nothing to do with them. And nobody would expect you to hire somebody from that other ethnic group or even be friends with them. That's how the situation was in these days. The Jews despised Gentiles, but they really, really didn't like the Samaritans because they were half-breeds. They were almost more despised than the Gentiles. So when Jesus does this, he is running against the grain of his cultural tradition of that day. But it's for a reason. Now, as you continue to work through the text, and we got to do, I'm not going to teach through the whole text, but Jesus says, verse 10, if you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. So again, he's going to interact with her. He's going to teach her a couple of principles here. She's going to grasp this guy. Whoa, he must be a prophet. How would he have known about my past? How would he know about the man I'm living with right now? He must be a prophet. But she kind of shifts the focus from her own sin once he gets into that, beginning at verse 19. She shifts the focus and says, sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. So he's probing in on her sin, exposing her sin. She shifts the direction to a religious question. Well, where is the proper place to worship? In Jerusalem? Or our father said here on this mountain, in Mount Gerizim. And what Jesus does, and this is the last point I want to make here, is he decides to use this as an opportunity to teach about worship. He says, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you don't know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship him. And finally, God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. Now, if I asked you to describe for me the section of the Scripture of the New Testament, particularly the Gospels, where Jesus teaches on worship, the clearest teaching on worship found coming from the lips of Jesus himself, where would you take me? To John 4. This is the clearest teaching Jesus gives on worship. What it is, how it's supposed to be done, and so forth. The significant thing is, who did he say it to? Who did he give the most concise, understandable definition of worship? Who did he give it to? A Samaritan woman of ill repute. Interesting that his greatest teaching on worship was given to a foreigner who he was culturally to have no contact with. Teaching her truths, that did she have any right to even receive teaching about the true worship of the true God in the eyes of that culture? No way. And yet he gives that truth to her. He doesn't give it to his disciples. He doesn't give it to the Jews. He gives it to this Samaritan woman. Wow, what a guy. What a radical. So there's significance in that. One of the significant things is for us as missionaries is sometimes the social or cultural outcasts, we may need to break a cultural taboo to reach them, but they may be the ones that are going to be powerfully used by our gospel, by our God, and respond best to our gospel. And then you understand the rest of the story. She goes into town and points a bunch of people to him. She says, I don't know who the guy is. I think he might be a prophet, but he told me everything I know. You need to come out and see him. And so she becomes an evangelist almost the moment she gets saved. All she's doing is pointing them to Jesus. And notice who they were, the Samaritans. Okay? And the last thing on that is keep in mind that in Acts chapter 1, verse 8, when Jesus says, you know, in response to the disciples' question, is now the time that you're going to restore the kingdom to Israel? And Jesus basically says, it's none of your business. Don't worry about the kingdom. Don't worry about when Israel's going to get the kingdom back. You guys stay here in Jerusalem until the Holy Spirit comes upon you and with power, and you will be what? My witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth. Now understand, that's not a geographic expansion. Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth. That's not a geographic expansion he's talking about. That's a cultural expansion. The gospel of the kingdom is to go forth, and it's obviously going to go forth across geographical boundaries, but even more significant are the cultural boundaries. When they heard Samaria, Samaria, huh? Wait a minute. You want us to go and preach the gospel in Samaria? Yeah. You need to love those who you despise the most. You need to be willing to go with the message of God's love to those that you despise the most. And the relevance for us today is all of us have Samaritans. All of us have Samaritans. There's a certain segment of people that we don't want to share the gospel with that we don't even really love. For some people, it's drug addicts. For some people, it's rapists. For some people, it's homosexuals. There's a certain segment or group of people in each one of our hearts that we would really not rather go and share with those kind of people. And what God is saying is you need to go even to the Samaritans. And empowered by my Holy Spirit, you can and preach the gospel. Okay? So, everybody got that? Significant incident, not just teaching on evangelism, but the relevance of culture. And as we continue to go through the class, what I told you is he strategically broke this cultural norm. He had thought it through ahead of time. There was a reason why he did it, and we'll work through some of those issues as we work through that process that we talked about last week. We'll get to that in a few weeks. All right, now, before we switch over to Hebert, I want to read something for you, and I think you guys are all aware and alert enough to pick up on the point that this is making. I get asked all the time, and I think a couple of you in this class have asked me, about short-term missions. Now, those of you that know me at all know that I'm really not the biggest guy to promote short-term missions. Short-term missions, I think, are a uniquely American thing that shows the superficiality of the church here in America. That the only reason we really need to do short-term trips is because we're so superficial, most of us, in our walks with the Lord, that unless we go and see and experience it ourselves, we won't be interested in missions. That's how superficial we are. So short-term missions is a part of our culture. I've referred to it as McMissions. And we have this reputation throughout the rest of the Christian world of a bunch of wimps because we're kings of short-term trips, which means they're not willing to go and commit long-term to what it takes to get the job done, and they've got the money to take short-term trips. Those Americans. So we have a negative view on this. So I am asked all the time, well, what do I think about short-term missions? And I do short-term mission trips, but I have a whole different view on why we do them. Most of what we do out there doesn't do any good for the mission that you're going to work with. So I don't want to burst any of your bubbles when you go on a short-term trip. You really don't help much. Matter of fact, you're probably a distraction most of the time to the ministry you're going to go help. But the significance of the short-term trip is in your life, what you see, what you experience, and we are such in our culture that we need that. The Koreans don't do that. The Brazilians don't do that. The rest of the world is praying for the world, and they don't have to spend $1,000 to go on a trip to do it. You see? So it's kind of a sign or an exposure of where we're at as a culture within the church here in America. Having said that, let me read this to you, and I think you'll get the point. A letter. Dear brothers and sisters, Pastor Umpatanga Wampkin from Panga Panga will be coming to your church's neighborhood to hold a crusade next week. He is certain that your church will fully cooperate with the crusade, even though he didn't ask your permission, help, or input. After all, he is a mighty man of God. He told me so himself. Pastor Umpat will be speaking through a translator. He's not bothered learning your language or customs because what he has to say is so important, he knows your people will be excited to hear every word he has to say. After all, he is from Panga Panga, where God is moving mightily. And Pastor Umpat will be dressed as he has a right to dress in his own country, the wonderful Panga Panga, in a loincloth. He knows that this will be respected, for it is his customary manner of dress in his own country, and he has the right to dress as his custom. Pastor Umpat will be expecting to preach in your church on Sunday morning. After all, he is from Panga Panga, and he is a mighty man of God. So even though he does not know your customs or your language, and although you have never heard of him before, simply because he is from Panga Panga and is a mighty man of God, he knows your pastor will readily open the pulpit to him to preach the word of God. Pastor Umpat will soon be sending a team of people from his congregation in Panga Panga to do a missions trip in your neighborhood. Most of them have never witnessed in their own neighborhood, but they're excited about coming to tell your neighbors about Jesus through a translator, of course. And they won't be spending any time learning about your culture, for they will be preaching Jesus, and they are mighty Christians from Panga Panga, the world-renowned center of the revival of God on earth. They told me they are mighty Christians themselves. While this mission team is in your neighborhood, they'll be showing you and your congregation the right way to do evangelism. They are missionaries, you know, which means that they know better than we do, even though they have had no special training and they are from God's country, Ponga Ponga. Even though many of the members of this team have some severe problems in their lives with carnality, they know that the mighty power of God is so mighty in their ministry that these little problems, like gluttony, grumbling, rebellion, etc., will not interfere with the revival that they are going to bring to your neighborhood. They are sure you have been waiting for them to come and show you the way. They are mighty Christians from God's country, Ponga Ponga.
And undoubtedly, you will overlook their manner of dress, according to their rites and customs in their country, the men in loincloths and the women bare-breasted, since they love the Lord so much. Such little things will not be a distraction, I'm sure. They are mighty Christians from God's country, Ponga Ponga. So, while they often will be diverting themselves at the swimming pool, or with some of their own eccentric pastimes, when it comes time for them to speak to your congregation through a translator, they know you'll be blessed, for they are mighty Christians from God's country, Ponga Ponga. How's that feel? Short-term missions. American short-term missions. Now, not that I'm trying to kill you guys on short-term missions. Some missionary probably wrote that. And it's true. This is how the rest of the world views us. And think about it. If somebody came from another country to your neighborhood, would your pastor let a Japanese team into your church? Teach your Sunday school through a translator? Speak in your pulpit through a translator? You know, would you be sitting there saying, oh yeah, come on, we need to show you how to do evangelism. We need to show you how to do children's ministry. We need to show you how to do this. Implying what? You don't know how to do any of that, even though you're doing it. You see? So, there's a tension in the whole realm of short-term missions. It's a uniquely American kind of thing. Because A, we have the money to do short-term missions trips. And so that opens doors for us that most of the rest of the world can't have. Now, am I totally down on short-term teams? No, I'm not. But they have to be done properly. They have to be, the people need to be trained. They need to understand the culture. And they need to be given from the beginning the reality of what they're going to accomplish when they're over there. And most of what they're going to accomplish is not going to really help the church or the ministry that you're going over there to assist. It's going to be for the members of the team. The church over there is blessed by you coming, but they don't need you. And they want to build relationship with you. You see? Now, in some countries, we have doors open to us as Americans that are not going to be open to the nationals. And those are things that we need to take advantage of as Americans. Use those open doors that we can get into because we are Americans, and that's a whole other cultural realm in itself. But we need to take advantage of those, but understand that most of the time, short-term teams, the greatest impact of a short-term team is on the member that went on the team. It does very little good in a practical sense for the ministry that you go over to assist. Okay? Now, I don't want to burst anybody's bubble, but any missionary who lives on the field will tell you this. They won't tell you this unless they trust you, but believe me, everybody who lives on the field and is trying to do a specific work for God will basically tell you the same thing. Yes, we like short-term teams, but their usefulness is very limited, and it's an incredible amount of work and distraction from what I'm really here to do to take care of the Americans for the 2 weeks they're here. When I received the teams for 2 weeks, and actually quite a bit of time before that, what was I doing? I had to disengage from the church planning that I was doing. To set it up, to make sure that everything was going to be just right. And when they were there, I had to basically stop doing the ministry that God called me there to do, to entertain the Americans. There's language barriers, there's culture barriers, and so forth. So, you're going to get the truth from me, I'll tell you the truth, and I got nothing to lose because I'm not a missionary on the field anymore. A lot of missionaries that are in the field will be hesitant to speak as frankly because, obviously, it could affect them in their support realm. And one of the reasons why a lot of missionaries will receive as many teams as possible is for that. The more people have exposure to what they're doing, the more likely it is their support is going to build. Now, that's not a bad thing, and that's not a bad motive, but that's the reality. And if you get a missionary, I'm talking about a missionary that's been on the field for a year or more. If you find somebody that's been out there for that long and you can get them to talk
honestly, this is the kind of stuff we talk about when we're together. Okay? So I don't have to fear any of those things because I'm not a missionary on the field anymore. See? And I want you to be aware, as short-term teamers, and some of you are going to go on short-term teams, you need to be aware of these kind of things. Okay? Everybody got that? All right. Now, so when I train people for short-term teams, which I do, I kind of speak a little more frankly to them than what they want me to, and I burst a few bubbles. But it's worth bursting their bubbles now rather than having learned this at a future point in time. You know, you need to be aware of that. And most of the training that I do, though, as far as these classes and the missionaries that I spend a lot of time with are people that are going to go out there and stay there. Okay? And usually, in the realm of missions, if you're going out for less than 2 years, you're a short-term team. You're a short-termer. Okay? Most Americans can't even fathom that. Less than 2 years in the field, you're still considered in the short-term realm. Because it takes a good 2 years to get in, get the language down, and get a good handle on the culture where you're going to make an impact that lasts. Okay? So, to a lot of people, 6 months is like a long time. It's not. It's just unique to us as Americans that that's a long time because we're not used to committing to anything longer than, you know, a few months in any part of our life, including our church life, which is why you have numbers of people transferring churches all the time. All right? Matter of fact, 80% of churches turn over their whole church population every 4 years. You know that? Every 4 years, the American church turns over 80% of its congregation. They go to different churches. So, anyway, having said that and having sobered you up a little bit, let's pick up with Hebert today. Now, this is, again, as I said, some interesting stuff. We start to get into the interesting stuff. And keep in mind that Hebert is writing here not for short-term missions. He's writing for missionaries that are going to go to the field and stay there. Okay? Now, some of these things will be relevant for short-termers, but most of these things are going to affect long-term missionaries, okay? People that are going to stay out there a couple of years or more. So, what he does is he begins this chapter with cultural differences in the new missionary, and he talks about cultural differences there on page 61, and we don't want to get into too much of those, and he kind of summarizes on page 62 in the middle of the page the reality that everybody sees the same world, but they perceive it through different cultural glasses. What is that called?
Worldview.
Exactly. The worldview of different groups of people determines their culture. Their culture is based on their worldview. And he kind of gives you a little diagram there on the bottom of page 62. Cultures see the world in different ways. Culture A sees things triangular, and notice it's organized. But culture B sees things circular, and notice that there's not a linear type pattern. It's a circular type pattern. And he gives a really good example here in one of the areas talking about time. Now, we're going to look at causes of culture shock here in a minute. But I want to use this as a good example because we talked a few weeks ago when we were talking about worldview and what is the time sense of human life. We talked about how man views time. And so he says at the top of page 63 that in Egypt, in traditional Egypt, when you set a time appointment with somebody, let's say you and I are both Egyptians and we're somewhat wealthy Egyptians, and we say, well, we're going to meet at 2 o'clock. Well, we can meet up to 2:30 and neither one of us are late. But if I set up an appointment for you at 2 o'clock, and you're not on the same cultural or pure level as me, socioeconomic level as me, if I set up an appointment for you at 2 o'clock to meet you, you need to show up at 2 o'clock because you're lesser than I am. You're not as important as I am. You don't have the status that I have. But it would be wrong for me to meet you at 2 o'clock because that would give the perception that we're equal. See, if we set up an appointment with somebody that's on the same level of us and we meet at the same time, no problem. But when you set up a meeting with somebody who is less than you, that's a servant or is in a less recognized position or a position of less status, they're expected to be there at 2 o'clock. Then I would come at 2:30 and everything would be fine. I wouldn't need to apologize to you. You had to be on time because you're not as important in the culture as I am. You don't have the status in the culture that I have. And so then what he does is he explains how we as Americans work. See, we as Americans are egalitarian. We don't care how important the person is, generally speaking. If we set up a 2 o'clock meeting, no matter who he is or who she is, we meet him at 2 o'clock. And he's got some time references there, 5 minutes. You need to kind of mumble an apology if you're an American and you're 5 minutes late. If you're 10 minutes late, you need to give a little better apology. If it's 15 minutes, it's kind of insulting to the person that's waiting for you. And then, you know, after half an hour, you know, and I mean, I'm even this way now that I live back, I leave. If you're not there within a half an hour of the time we set up, I got other things to do, you know, so I'm going to move on. And that's accepted in our culture. The person who was late would then owe me an apology for taking up my time and they never showed up on time. Now, we understand that. That's our culture. The Egyptians understand it. That's their culture. But then you've got a problem. What happens if you work with an Egyptian? What happens if you are working side by side as a missionary with an Egyptian that has the same status as you? And you set up an appointment for 2 o'clock, and you show up at 2 o'clock, and he doesn't show up till 2:30. Do you see any problem there? Do you see any potential conflict? Yeah. The Egyptian's going to think, what are you? I thought we were equals. I thought we were the same status. Servants show up at the exact time, 2 o'clock. So maybe you're not as high status as I am. And so he could think down upon you. The American shows up at 2 o'clock, and the Egyptian shows up at 2:30. And what does the American think of the Egyptian? This guy has no concept of time. You know, he needs to go back to college. He needs to learn that God's people need to be wise with the time that God's given them. And all of a sudden, you've got potential conflict there. Why? Cultural differences in the view of time. So being aware of that then would what? You'd be able to dissolve some of the tension that's going to be there. So he gives that example. Okay? He talks about these missionaries in the Marshall Islands. And I flew through the Marshall Islands one time. I don't know if you know where that's at. It's kind of way out there in the West Pacific. I was going to Guam. And matter of fact, I almost became a missionary to Majuro in the Marshall Islands. And the Marshall Islands, really, they're not islands. They're atolls. And they're like, it's hard to describe it, but they're like coral reefs that have been there for a long time. And they've grown to the surface and they end up becoming like islands. But they're really not. They're not connected to the ground underneath by mountains and all that stuff. They're reefs, basically, that are stationary. You fly into Majuro in the Marshall Islands. This thing is like, I don't know the exact, but it's like a mile long, and it's 300 yards wide at its widest point. That's the thing. And you're in the middle of the ocean, and you fly into there, and it's like, whoa, man. You're like, you land, you know, it's the road, and then at the end of the road is the runway. The thing is 300 yards wide at its widest point, but goes for a mile. And you got a couple thousand people living on this place in the middle of nowhere, the Marshall Islands. So he gives this little example here of, you know, humorous of some of the natives from the Marshall Islands, you know, having the missionaries there. And in those days, the mail was only dropped off once a year. And all the missionaries really liked when the mail came. Well, it happens that the missionaries were off island when the mail came a day early. So all the natives said, wow, those Americans really like that. They really said that they were fed and encouraged by the letters they received. So they decided to boil the letters and try to eat them, because the Americans said that they got fed off of the letters that the people had written to them. And when the missionaries got back, all their letters that they only got once a year were mush. So sometimes this can, you know, present humorous situations. But if you're an American that had been waiting a year for your letters, you might be a little angry at the local guys for trying to eat your letters, and now you can't read them. So sometimes these things are humorous. Okay. Now, beginning on page 64, we begin to talk about culture shock. Okay. We begin to talk about culture shock, and he breaks it down into five major categories. He talks about language shock, changes in routine, changes in relationships, loss of understanding, and emotional and evaluative disorientation. In other words, he's going to summarize for us what culture shock is, and I'll do that for you in a second, and then he's going to give us the components of culture shock. Okay? But in some of my other readings and in some of a lot of the other missionaries that I work with, And as we kind of talked about this over the years, the initial thing that you get when you go to a country is culture shock. We like calling the rest of the time that you're there and the things you go through culture stress. Culture shock goes away. Culture stress never does. So, culture shock. Okay, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this in a, you know, next week. But the reality of it is, when you take a short-term trip, if you take a short-term trip, you go to a country for whatever, however long, 10 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And you get there and you're pumped. Your sensitivities are up. You're on a mission from God. You're flexible. You can eat chicken feet for the whole 14 days that you're there because you know you're going home. So you land there and it's hot. If it's a tropical place, it's hot and humid, something totally foreign to where you're from. Or you know, if you're from the tropics, you go someplace and it's freezing cold and 5 feet of snow. The colors are different. The smells are very significant in our culture. Certain smells trigger certain memories and cultural feelings and so forth. Smell is significant in culture. And you get there and you're on the short-term trip and you're just, your antennas are up and you're just like, you're digging it. You're loving it. Man! You see? And so you're there for those 2 weeks and you love that new smell. Even though it may be disgusting at times, it's a new smell and it's exciting and it's adventurous. And boy, you're trying to listen to the language and it's so fun to listen to the language. And you're eating all this new food and everything and you're going around in different methods of transportation and there's no phones. You know, if you want to talk to somebody, you have to take a public transportation to go over and see them. And it's all so cool. It's all so new. And then you go home. You see? And man, you had a great short-term experience. Well, you never really got culture shock because you knew you were going home in a matter of weeks. Okay? But something happens when you go to stay. And what happens is culture shock. All that stuff that on your short-term trip was a lot of fun and exciting and adventuresome, when the planes fly away and you're still there, and this is what you're going to call home from now on, all of a sudden those smells are not fun anymore. That language that you can't understand, it's not interesting anymore. It's bothersome. It gives you a sense of insecurity, and we'll talk about that. And all of a sudden, the reality sets in that I'm not going home in 2 weeks. I'm committed for 2 years here. I'm not going to be back to that which is familiar. And a shock rumbles through the very core of your being. You don't get culture shock, really, on a short-term trip. You get a taste of it, but it doesn't hit you until you're going to stay there for a length of time. And so it's funny, you know, again, being out in the field, and I'm speaking from experience out on the field, how many people would come on a short-term trip, one of these teams, and say, oh, this is no problem, man. I could be a missionary here. Man, you guys, I thought you were missionaries, you know? You know, is this suffering for Jesus? And you just kind of go, they don't even know. They're leaving in 2 weeks. They know their ticket. They're out of here in 10 days. When you're going to live there, a whole different frame of reference comes into your mind. And so what we're going to talk about is culture shock and the components of culture shock. Okay? As he begins to talk about it at the bottom of page 64, he gives a couple of good examples. And let me just read them through some of them here. We stop at a restaurant and we order lunch. Now, again, you're not going to get on a short-term trip if you don't eat the lunch because it looks disgusting or whatever. No big deal. You know, you got snacks in your bag back at the hotel to get you by. But when you're going to live there, all of a sudden, you order your food, but when it comes, you recognize only half of it as food. The other half looks inedible, like worms or even ants. So hungry, you stop at the market and you ask for some oranges. But the woman in the stall doesn't understand. You suddenly realize that all people don't speak English. Desperate for something to eat, we point like children to our mouths and stomachs, and then to the oranges. When the vendor finally understands and gives us fruit, we face another problem. How do we pay for it? We don't understand her, and the new coins don't make any sense to us. Finally, in desperation, we hold them out and let her take what she wants. And again, all missionaries relate to this, okay? You hold it out there, and you just know, as he says, she's ripping you off. You know that you don't understand the monetary system, so you're trusting that she's not going to rip you off. And she gives you back your change, and you're thinking, boy, I wonder how much I got ripped off here. Okay? To make matters worse, the children nearby are making fun of us. Obviously amused that these wealthy and educated people cannot speak a language that any local three-year-old knows well. Culture shock. You, Mr. American, You, Mr. Educated, you here to change them and impact the world for Christ. The three-year-old kids are laughing at you. The five-year-old kids are laughing at you because you can't even speak the language that their little friends speak. And all of this starts to close in on you. Then the last paragraph before he says causes of culture shock, he says, as anxieties multiply, we seem to get little done beyond keeping ourselves alive. Everything is strange. Everybody looks alike. We have few friends to whom we can turn for help, and we cannot admit defeat and go home. Unlike the tourists, we can't even go to the local Hilton and its familiar settings. What has happened to our dreams? Every missionary goes through culture shock. No one has ever gone to the field and not gone through culture shock. And those of you from other countries went through culture shock coming here. The first time you may have come on holiday, no problem. 2-3 weeks in America, great. But when you come here to live, culture shock sets in. Okay? Now, what are the causes? We're going to start to look at them. He summarizes culture shock at the top of page 66 with, it's the disorientation we experience when all the cultural maps and guidelines we learned as children no longer work. Okay, this is his definition of culture shock. We have a disorientation that comes when all of the cultural maps and guidelines that we learned as kids don't work anymore. We've been stripped of our normal ways of coping with life. We're confused, angry, and afraid. We rarely know what has gone wrong, much less what should we do about it. Okay? Now, that's a pretty good summary of what culture shock is. And what causes this disorientation is, again, all the familiar things that make you who you are and make you be able to live day to day comfortably, they're all taken away. So your comfort zone is under attack. In the next paragraph, he says the severity depends upon the extent of the difference between the culture, the personality of the individual, and the methods used to cope with the new situation. Okay, how much culture shock will you have? Those three things determine how much you'll have. Now, Debbie's from England. We're somewhat similar in cultures, although different. And you're from Sweden, so there are some similarities. But, you know, this being here is not like being in Vietnam. Okay, so the difference between your culture and the one you go to will determine how much culture shock you feel. But even if it's only a slight difference, it still makes an impact. Even, I forget your name. Lisa was in Mississippi last week and was talking before the class about how even different the culture is in Mississippi from California. Okay, so the three things that help determine how radical the culture shock is are: how radical is the difference between cultures? The extent of the differences between cultures. That will make a difference. Secondly, your personality. And we'll talk about this as we go through. Some personality types are just not called to be cross-cultural ministers. Some people just, the way they are personality-wise, just cannot deal in other cultures. And they shouldn't be out on the field. And also, the third thing is the methods used to cope with the new situations. So you're going to have it, but it can be lessened by knowing how to deal with it. And that's kind of what we're going to talk about next week. How do you deal with it, with culture shock? Because you will have it. And if you know ahead of time that you're probably going to have it, see, the problem is a lot of guys go out there without any training. They just think, hey, I'm a Christian, and God's used us here, and God gave me the money, so I'm going to buy a ticket, and away I go. And they get out there, and culture shock hits, because it always hits, and they don't know how to deal with it. They haven't been prepared. They didn't expect it, and now they're melting down. And they don't know how to deal with it. And a little significant statistic, if you haven't heard the statistic yet, is more people fall away from the Lord coming back to the United States than going to the field. As bad as culture shock is, when you come back from the field early, earlier than you told everybody you would, and culture shock has overwhelmed you there, the number of people falling away from Christ is much greater coming back to your own culture than going to the original culture where you go. Okay? Wounded missionaries. I got a call, spent 45 minutes with a wounded missionary yesterday that spent many years in a foreign country, Calvary Chapel person, and is just, you know, whipped coming back from the mission field. And people here don't understand how to minister to them. People here don't understand what they went through. And also they went over without any preparation or training themselves, knowing that this would happen and giving them tools ahead of time to deal with it when it does happen. You see, when you get married, if you're a Christian, how many of you would get married without some premarriage counseling? You need premarriage counseling before you get married. Know what kind of issues you're going to deal with ahead of time, and then learn biblical principles on how to deal with them. I mean, we all take it for granted. If you're a Christian, you're going to get married, you're going to get some premarriage counseling. Well, going to the mission field is as radical as getting married in many ways. Well, why would we do that without any preparation, without any training? And that's why it's good that you guys are in this class. Yes?
So what could this person struggle with when he comes back?
Well, we'll get to it later on reentry, some of the problems with reentry. But part of the problem is this person that went out unprepared. And so although they learned to deal in the culture over there, it really got to them the first couple of years they were there. And so you have two things working. On the one hand, he was unprepared to go to the field and deal with the reality of culture shock. He wasn't given the tools to do that, but he made it through. But there's a scars left in the process. And now he's come back here, and he wasn't prepared for reentry. And the people here don't know how to minister to missionaries. Most Americans don't have a clue about what a missionary goes through upon coming back from the field. And that's another thing we'll talk about, that anybody in my classes will hopefully have a little handle on how to minister to missionaries, because they are special. They are unique. And not that they're better than anybody else, but the reality of it is being in the field changes you radically. And most people don't know how to deal with the radicalness of those changes. Okay? So, first thing that causes culture shock is language shock. The first thing that's going to hit you when culture shock is going to slap you is the reality that you can't communicate in this new culture. Some language training before you go is nice, but sometimes you can't get it till you're there. But the reality of it is we are communicators. Of all cultures, we are some of the most verbal people on the planet. Verbal and also written, literary expressions. Okay? When you go to a cross-cultural situation, the first thing that happens is you can't communicate. And I think I talked about this a few weeks ago, but you know, the root of the word communication is a Latin word called communis, C-O-M-M-U-N-I-S. The root of the word communication is this word communis, and you know that means we get our words communion from, we get communication from, community, but the word actually literally means to make common. To make common. If you don't make something common, you are not communicating. When you talk about marriage, if there's problems in communication, what is the root of the problem? The problem is that whatever is on the heart or in the mind of this person is not being made common so that the other person can understand it, receive it, and be part of it with them. That's what communication is. It's making something common. So in our culture, we communicate. We share things in common. When you go to a different culture and you don't understand the language, you can't communicate. You can't make things common, and you can't take that which is common to somebody else and appropriate it unto yourself. So communication is blocked up. It's clogged. And shock sets in. He says, suddenly, as strangers in a new world, we're stripped of our primary means of interacting with other people. What's the primary way you guys interact with other people? Language. Now, you go to a different country, and your primary way of interacting with people is taken away. You can't communicate. What is that going to do to you? Force you into some desperate thoughts, perhaps. It might stimulate you to want to learn the language, or it might just cause you to draw into a shell, and why bother? When you see these international students on this campus, have a heart for them. Put yourself in their position. Go to school in Beijing, China. Let's say you've learned, well, how many of you have had Spanish in high school? Everybody's had Spanish 1 or 2 years in high school. Imagine going with that amount of Spanish that you know and going to Mexico City to go to university. And how many of those people speak English? None. How would you feel walking around that campus every day and having roommates every day, and all you can communicate with them is that little Spanish that you learned in high school? You're going to feel isolated? Yeah, well, you've got international students on this campus that are in the exact same position. You know, you as mission students ought to be the ones reaching out to them, taking the time to get to know them, giving them opportunities to practice their English, because nobody else has time to let them practice their English. And if they practice it with one another, are they going to improve their English? No, they're not. They're going to, if they speak with a Japanese English speaker and they're a Japanese English speaker, are they ever going to speak English the way we do? Or even close to it? No. Will you guys take the time to do that? Plus, you're demonstrating the love of Christ. So language is crucial. And he makes the point that logic is identified. We think that it's illogical what's going on, the way these people communicate. But logic is identified with familiar ways of talking and thinking. Logic is tied up in culture. It's not supercultural, it's cultural. And it's tied up with communication.